This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars, episode 100, was recorded on April 6th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. I'll tell you how to claim a free copy of their new guide to the best investing books ever written at the end of this episode. Joining me for our 100th All-Stars episode is our 100% top All-Star, Dr. Pippa Malmgren. Pippa, it's great to have you back on the show. It's been way too long. I want to start with the coronavirus crisis, which you've talked about quite a bit in your other media interviews. I'm going to just be bold here, Pippa, and say, as much as this is a once in 100 years kind of horrible, just nasty, ugly, horrible event, I think the government reaction to the coronavirus crisis poses a greater threat to Americans than the crisis itself. And the reason I say that is it's just this crazy amount, unprecedented amounts of both fiscal and monetary intervention, trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, that I don't think is really going to change anything about the virus, but it is very likely going to ruin our economy, at least in my perspective. What do you think? Am I crazy to think that? And how do you see the situation?
No, I'm with you. And let me put it in a slightly different way. This is going to sound strange, but the economy is a lot like a human COVID-19 patient because vulnerability is largely a function of pre-existing conditions. So just as if you have asthma or a lung issue, you are vastly more vulnerable. The same with the economy. And because it was already burdened by record debt, huge amount of leverage, a lot of uncertainty already about the economy in particular places like Britain, where I live, where Brexit was a cause of massive uncertainty. Then you get this virus and suddenly you're just much more vulnerable than you would have been otherwise. So what I'm arguing is that COVID-19 is not only killing the patients now, it's killing the economy. And our policymakers have this view that you can kind of put the economy into snooze mode, like an alarm, and you can just revive it later. But I think this is a wrong diagnosis. It's like a first triage diagnosis that we can come back to this patient shortly. But no, what we're doing is not appreciating that this is not about one firm or one sector. It's about every aspect of the economy being turned off at the same time. And the ruin this causes is itself infectious. And so the risk is that the whole economy and the personal financial position of every individual collapses all at the same time. And this is, again, in a world where most people depend on the next paycheck and don't have any savings, where most businesses are not earning more than the cost of running them. And so the bottom line is the diagnosis has been incorrect. And so this view that you can throw cash at this problem in the form of quantitative easing is not working because it assumes a number of things. It assumes that the banks will on-lend the money, but the banks can't on-lend the money because the credit criteria of every potential borrower is collapsing every day. And so the banks are not even, there's no way they can on-lend the money. But even if they did, even if you had, you know, tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands or even millions in cash sitting in your bank account today, you have no sense of the timing and you have no sense of the personal risk, human health risk that you would be taking to start up a new business or to even go buy broken assets. And because of that, throwing cash at people doesn't fix it either. And so my view is that the stage two of the triage is going to be the recognition that what has to happen here is it's kind of like, you're throwing dish rags on a fire, on a grease fire. We've misdiagnosed the nature of the fire and it doesn't respond to certain sorts of stuff. It responds to others. So my view is we're going to get to a stage where we realize that it's not even a bailout. What we have to do is use this window of opportunity to write off a lot of the debt and to recognize that government has to provide the guarantee for the whole economy and for as long as is necessary. So it's not about the airlines or any particular airline. It's about every individual citizen's bank account. And you have to do that because you also don't know when this is going to end, because we could have rolling lockdowns. This is what we're seeing in both China and Japan. They thought they were done. They said, everybody, it's cool. And then they get hotspots that flare and they have to shut it all again. So in light of that timing uncertainty, I think that we're going to have to look at much broader ranging solutions, because this is not a financial problem. This is a societal problem. They're two very, very different things, if that makes sense.
Pippa, I feel that there's, maybe this is just part of how Washington works, but I feel that the whole bailout conversation is completely misinformed. President Trump keeps talking about, well, look, this was not the airline's fault. We've got to bail them out. This is not the cruise line's fault. We've got to bail them out. This is not so-and-so's fault. We've got to bail them out. Well, look, it's not my fault either, and it's not your fault, Pippa, but the government is not a source of money. I don't understand why people can't seem to see that. The government, if it wants to use money to bail anyone out, has to get it from one of two places. Either they've got to tax somebody for it, which means you're saying, well, we need to bail out person A, but person B has to be the one to pay for person A to get bailed out. Or they print the money, in which case you're diluting the value of everyone's savings and you're creating a condition which is progenerative to secular inflation in the future, which could have a crippling effect on the future of society. Nobody seems to be talking about the other side of where the money comes from. It's like, well, so-and-so deserves a bailout. Where's the money come from if not from other people who are also in a very difficult position right now? Why are we even talking about all these bailouts? It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, no, I totally hear you. First of all, I think you're right. If we're going to do a bailout, it needs to be for the entire society. It's not for one particular company or sector. And that's what government hasn't registered yet. It's not limited. It's everyone, and every balance sheet is now being sucked into a highly destructive vortex that can't be undone. And so the main thing is to protect humans, real people, rather than companies and balance sheets. And this will lead to a huge discussion about, you know, is it right that corporates haven't been paying their full share of tax? And that bigger, broader discussion is inevitably gonna roll out here. But I want to come to your point, where is the money coming from? So I think the danger is that we've had now a couple of decades where the consensus view has been inflation is dead. Anyone who raises it has lost their marbles. And as you know, I've been writing about this extensively in recent years, saying that there's more inflation in the system than the official data tells us. And you know it because the whiskey in a bar is costing you a lot more. And have you noticed your rent per square foot is rising and your box of cereal in the morning costs the same, but there's less inside? These have all been symptoms of slightly more inflation. And in terms of the official numbers in the US, we went from roughly a 1% inflation rate during the financial crisis back in 2009 to roughly 2.5% inflation most recently. Well, this is an extraordinary leap in inflation, even though it sounds like a small number. And so because the belief system is that inflation is dead and you don't need to worry about it, and because we did money printing last time and it did not result in any kind of terrible, nefarious outcome, the view today is you can do this with equanimity. You can do this and there's absolutely no side effect. And if I stand here and say, well, actually, all of the pressures that were containing inflation are now gone. So we used to have global supply chains holding inflation down, holding prices down. Well, the supply chain is broken at both ends now. We've got a supply shock and a demand shock. And it's not just that people won't buy from China anymore. It's China won't sell anymore. You know, countries are implementing export controls on, for example, medicines, foodstuffs. So even if you wanted to buy it from them, they won't sell it to you anymore. And that's not just emerging markets. Even countries like the UK are looking at doing things like that. So now global supply chains are not holding prices down anymore. And it used to be that tech was holding prices down. You know, incredible rapid innovation was a huge, huge downward force on prices. Well, now you're going to see a whole lot of tech startups go bust. And you're going to see that funding for speedy growth of tech companies is not there. So now you've lost the second major downward pressure. And so then you're going to add all this new money that you've magicked up out of nowhere, and you're going to lose all of the downward pressure on prices. And that's what takes you to the conclusion that actually what you're doing is setting the stage for the kind of inflation that we haven't even been reading about. We've dismissed it as a possibility now for decades. And of course, that's exactly when things tend to go awry, is when you've got certainty that something is impossible. And in fact, almost everything we thought was impossible has actually happened in recent years. So just to be clear, I'm not saying we're heading into a Weimar Republic, but I am saying we're taking some unbelievable risks right now with total disregard to the possible consequences.
I don't even see them as risks, Pippa. I see them as certain outcomes. And the way I would describe this, tell me if you disagree, is look, it's true that this crisis is so extreme that we've got to do something. And the need of government to bail out society and help people who are in dire circumstances and need help. From a humanitarian standpoint, there's no choice but to do it. The thing is, under these circumstances, you can't get the money for that bailout by taxing somebody. Your only choice is to monetize the bailout, to print the money, which has the effect of essentially assuring something you and I thought was probably pretty darn close on the horizon anyway, which is a shift into secular inflation. Unlike quantitative easing, which inflated asset markets, we're talking about bailouts that go to help real people in the real world who spend their money in the real economy. So that leads to consumer price inflation. And it seems to me, you know, sometimes in the medical profession, they'll tell the patient, they have ethical rules where they have to tell the patient what's at stake. Look, we can save your life, but we have to cut off your leg in order to do it. You're going to lose the leg. There's no choice. We're sorry. So, Pippa, would you agree with me that the certain cost or near certain cost of this bailout, which I don't think we've seen the whole bailout yet, it's probably going to get bigger. It seems like every couple of days, it's another $2 trillion. It seems to me like the certain price that the doctor's not telling us we have to pay for that treatment is a shift to secular inflation that will probably be at least as bad as the 1970s. Would you agree with that?
I do think it's a shift to secular inflation. I think we don't know yet about the magnitude, but I will say this. I do like the medical analogy. And another layer of it is that, you know, with the COVID virus, your body's immune system starts to turn on itself. It detects that there's a threat. But what kills a lot of people is not the disease. It's your effort to fight off the disease as your body attacks itself. Well, in a way, that's exactly what's happening with the economy. And people start to close businesses in anticipation of the big slowdown, trying to limit their losses now so they don't have bigger losses later. And in this way, the economy kills itself. It cannibalizes itself. So yes, I agree with this view as well, that the doctor, the policymaker, should be telling us there will be consequences to the treatment that we're giving you. It may save you from killing yourself, but you may have to face a completely different operating environment where your money is not worth what it was. Now, the thing about inflation is that it's not just about inflation, it's about inflation expectations. And one of the strange qualities of this crisis we're in is that the shortages created by the virus are very real. People have been in the grocery stores. They've seen that they've run out of eggs. And today, what are you willing to pay for an egg? Answer, a lot. Like, I don't know, are you willing to pay a dollar for an egg? Yeah. And so this is how inflation expectations begin. It's not that the whole economy experiences it all at once. Is that you personally start to understand the possibility that a price might be higher in future. Now, right now, people think this is silly because they're like, oh, don't be ridiculous. Property markets are going to collapse. Asset values are going to collapse. Like, we're in such a deflationary downdraft. You don't even have to worry about inflation. Well, it may be true, but for how long? And that's my question is, it's once the assets start to clear, and hopefully that happens sooner rather than later. I would argue strongly to facilitate that. But whenever that happens, that's when the fact that you have more money chasing the same number of loaves of bread starts to be a real phenomena. And that's the way to think about it. It's inflation is not a number on a chart. Inflation is your willingness to pay more to be the person who gets to take that last loaf of bread home from the grocery store and not the person who missed it. And people are already understanding right now what that feels like.
Well, Pippa, one thing that economic history teaches us is there is a trap. People say, look, we've got such a huge deflationary backdraft. It's not a worry. Show me any major secular inflation in all of world history that was not preceded by a sharp puff of deflation before it. And there are none, whether it's Weimar Germany or anywhere else. All of the major inflations were preceded by deflations. And there was some big catalyzing event that turned the tide. And I think that the monetary and fiscal response to this coronavirus crisis is going to be that catalyst event that shifts the system from a deflationary to an inflationary backdrop. And the thing, something that I've predicted for more than a decade now, as I said, I don't know when the inflation is coming, but when it gets here, it's going to change the game completely. Because one of the benefits, as difficult as this deflation that we've had since 2008 has been for many people in many ways, it does have a fringe benefit, which is almost any problem you can at least paper over the problem with the printing press. All you do is you conjure more money out of thin air and throw it at the problem, and you can make a lot of problems go away, at least temporarily, that way. When you have an inflationary backdrop, all of a sudden, quantitative easing doesn't work anymore because it exacerbates the inflation. And so all of a sudden, the central bankers' hands are tied and they don't have this magic printing press to get them out of trouble. I don't think that governments in general, including central bankers whose job is to understand this stuff, are ready or even cognizant of the fact that their hands are going to be tied and their magic printing press is not going to work the way it used to when we get to this inflationary backdrop. Do you agree? And what other knock-on effects and consequences of a shift to inflation should we be thinking about?
You see, policymakers are thinking that, well, first of all, policymakers tend not to be so savvy about how the economy works. So I'll repeat again this simple idea that they really think you can put the economy into snooze mode. And then when you decide to wake up an hour later, it will just still be exactly where it was. But it isn't where it was. And the losses there are permanent and real. So the QE doesn't prevent the losses. It basically slows down the pace at which the losses are occurring. Right? You still are fundamentally losing real value in the economy. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, they think we're still operating within the existing system that we have, come to know. They're not understanding this event changes the level of confidence in the system as a whole. In other words, you may not even have the option of preserving the system, let alone the individual components of it. And that's why inflation isn't so much about the value of the money. It's about the loss of confidence in the system that makes it. And this is why I think what we're going to see is a strange combination. I think this is going to accelerate government efforts to introduce digital money, because you can put digital money in a person's bank account right now. And that is incredibly attractive to policymakers. And they have been thinking about doing it for ages. They just hadn't actually got that far yet. But I think they will go to that place once they realize they've bailed out a whole bunch of different sectors and still the people in their constituency are unable to pay for groceries and can't even buy any anyway because the grocery store is empty. And now you have real human hardship in your constituency on your hands. So they turn to digital money. Then the really dangerous bit is they start to try to get involved in the supply chain. And that's what happened in the Great Depression. The Great Depression, you know, Ben Bernanke would argue that the government saved the economy by throwing money at it. But people like Amity Schles would argue, well, actually, the government prolonged the slowdown because they started to get involved in the production of milk and bread and eggs because they felt the private sector wasn't producing enough. And the prices were starting to go up. So they said, you got to produce more. And so that's a nightmare. Once government starts trying to effectively nationalize the production of core goods, now you're basically, you're in a big problem. You're toast. And I don't know, I'm living in the UK, but already there are hints that the Conservative government here is talking about getting involved in the supply of stuff and nationalizing things. And in fact, the Labour Party here is like, wait, that was our whole campaign platform. And now you're just going to do exactly what we said we were going to do. But all these governments end the same way. Even if they try to nationalize it, they try to compel production to happen, what they quickly find out is that it's very hard to do it. It's very hard to run these organizations. So then they're up the creek because now you own it. And the next thing you know, they have to privatize. And I do think that privatization will happen if they attempt to nationalize these kinds of assets. And that's then what you've done is you've really destroyed confidence. Do we live in a socialist economy? Do we live in a capitalist economy? Do we live in one where everybody gets bailed out? Only some get bailed out? Nobody gets bailed out? These questions mean you no longer believe in the system. And this is when we get sharp breaks in history and you see the fall of not just the government, but of the whole structure of government and the beginning of new structures of government, not just new politicians.
I can't resist the temptation to throw in the advertisement, Pippa. For any new listeners, I published a book in 2018 called Beyond Blockchain, which is all about the coming digital currency revolution and why Pippa is exactly right that sovereign digital currency issued by governments is going to dominate. I'm sorry, Bitcoiners. It's not that I don't like you. It's just that I don't think your plans are realistic. Let's move on, though. All through this crisis, I've been thinking about you personally, Pippa, because I've been pondering things, thinking, boy, just gazillions of people in all sorts of different industries who've never considered it before have been forced to telecommute, to work from home, to find ways to be productive while working not in their office, not at the company that they work for. When the virus is gone, do we go back to the old normal, or is this going to be the catalyst that brings about a whole bunch of new changes where a whole bunch of people say, wait a minute, office space is expensive, and we kind of figured out that working at home thing, and it worked better than we thought after we got used to it. And what other kinds of societal changes might come out of this crisis because we were forced to try new things and learn new tricks?
Well, I think the impetus for digitization has accelerated like to Mach speed. And this is a good thing because, you know, most CEOs last year when surveyed by the Harvard Business Review said that their number one priority was digitization of the business, but most of them were failing to actually do it. Now they're doing it. And so we're going to see some institutions emerge much leaner, much more effective. They are going to lose a ton of overheads. This is going to have enormous implications for the property business, for just efficiencies across the board. On the other hand, that raises new issues about, well, what happens to all the people who've lost their foothold because the digital economy took over and there's no place for them now? And you know, I've been an optimist on that because I think over time, the economy always creates jobs for everybody. And we see that throughout history, that you almost always end up, even though you have dramatic structural change, you still end up with near record employment a lot of the time. But it's highly disruptive for any individual person's life. And so we're going to have a society that has a massive change to go through. And that's going to be hard individually for a lot of people. But I do think there are going to be great investment opportunities that come out of that. But, you know, at what cost to the health of the general society is a big question. The other thing is what gains we make, we've also got to consider the losses. In addition to that, let's think about how we're going to change the way we think, for example, about property. So I think the big change that has to happen is people who are in charge of giving planning permissions to properties, particularly in urban areas. So the way you solve this is you stop saying that buildings have to be single use, single purpose. Now you say, you know what? Technology allows us to have a building that has residential on some floors and an urban farm on some floors and office space on other floors and a grocery store on the ground level. And that kind of creative thinking would go a long way to diminishing the terrible, terrible lack of resilience that we're seeing in cities that, you know, simply can't produce enough food to feed their populations. This would be a great development in the property space. So yes, the demand for commercial office space goes down, but the demand for urban farming in urban areas goes up. So I could see a healthy readjustment there. The place where I don't see such a healthy readjustment has to do with the pensions and the private equity world. And there, I think that some of the losses that we're going to see happen will dwarf whatever gains we make with the technology. And, you know, let's face it, we live in a world where something like 30% of all the private equity has been financed by pension funds. And those pension funds are all going to experience sharp losses because that private equity is not going to perform the way we expected. And so while some of those companies may survive, and many of them may end up being these lean, mean, highly efficient, digitally based companies, still there's a loss. And the question is, can the pension funds reorient fast enough to get out of those losses and into the new digital space much faster? My guess is they won't be fast enough because they're not by nature fast. They rely on external consultants. They take a long time to change the asset allocations. And so I'm very worried that, yeah, you end up with lots of things that are investable, but the biggest institutions that should be investing simply can't because it's happening too quickly. And the nature of it is too pervasive for them to even comprehend what's the asset allocation change we would need to make.
I'm going to shift gears now to a completely different subject and tap a different part of your government service background brain. This crisis, right now the official story is the origin of the crisis was a seafood market in Wuhan, China. Now, less than 1,000 feet from that seafood market, the Chinese government operates a research laboratory that was doing research on bat coronaviruses. Now, so far, Pippa, the evidence is circumstantial and anecdotal at best, but a lot of people are saying, wait a minute, you're saying there's a research laboratory that is 1,000 feet from this seafood market where they were experimenting with bat coronaviruses. Now, the conspiracy theory crowd, of course, is saying, oh, it has to be a weapons research laboratory. Personally, I don't care whether it's a weapons research laboratory or just a regular research laboratory. Why is there a research laboratory that has super dangerous experimental coronaviruses being intentionally grown in a laboratory in a neighborhood that has a seafood market in it? I mean, I would think that's the kind of thing like, you know, they put the nuclear weapons research out in the middle of the desert. So if there's an accident, it blows up. It doesn't take a city down with it. It seems to me that, I don't think we should pick on China specifically. The United States has these laboratories where they do research on biological weapons. Why do we need to have these things? Now, I'm not saying, I don't know whether what happened here was something leaking out of a laboratory. Maybe it's just a coincidence that this laboratory is 1,000 feet from the seafood market. But even if it didn't in this particular case, there are laboratories operated by governments all around the world, including the U.S. government, that do have biological weapons in them that could, in an accident, be leaked out. Do we really need these kind of weapons?
Well, I think this is such a super interesting question about why are we spending so much money on biological weapons in the first place? And I have to say, you and I were doing this program when the first word of the lockdown in China came out. And I remember, you know, I definitely personally misjudged because I didn't know enough about it. And I certainly didn't anticipate we were going to end up where we are now. And I also was a little nervous because I think it's almost inevitable that people are going to go back and dissect this, and they're going to start asking questions about why were things being done in particular places. They're going to start connecting the dots between research activities at various bioweapons labs around the world, not just in China. They're going to ask, why are we involved in this space at all? And I have to say, I was feeling uneasy in that interview about even expressing a view because I didn't want to panic anybody, right? And this is another interesting thing about this kind of event is, you know, most people, even the experts, don't know. And we're never going to know because no government is ever going to concede that they're involved in this kind of stuff. But it is true, and your question is correct. We have to look at where is all this happening? And if you look in the States, you know, Fort Detrick is in Maryland, a state that I grew up in. That's where our premier biological biochemical weapons facilities has been for many, many decades. In China, they have more than one. I believe they have two level four labs in China. And, you know, they're not usually out in the middle of desert in the middle of nowhere. You know, nuclear testing's in those places, but not this stuff. And maybe now there are going to be questions about why are we handling these kinds of materials? Where are we handling these kinds of materials? But that's not the only issue. There's another one, too, which, you know, is an argument, but nobody's proved yet, which is also that the more aggressive humanity becomes in reaching out to new frontiers, whether that's deep in the Amazon or, you know, looking for certain kinds of animal life in remote locations, the more humans are coming into contact with animal species, the more opportunity there is for these kinds of viruses to jump. You know, one of the issues for China is that it's so tightly populated and you have this proximity issue. So if you have 10 people in a bedroom and some kind of a systematic problem breaks out with a virus, it moves really, really, really fast. So population, how condensed they are, how far reaching they are, these are all potentially contributing factors to this issue. So the point is we get them through history. I'm not sure they're ever going to go away, but we're certainly going to find governments being asked questions about what was the origin of this and how is it possible that we work on this kind of stuff in places where you could have a leak? This is definitely going to come up as a question.
Something I'm very concerned about in terms of the aftermath of this crisis is I am afraid that as I listen to President Trump and other officials in the U.S. government who have been pretty quick to publicly question, if not blame, the Chinese government's negligence in perhaps having accidentally released this virus from a laboratory, it almost doesn't matter whether that story is true or not. If that story becomes a populist sensation so that a lot of Americans develop the belief set that that's what happened, it seems to me that that could lead to a populist uprising of sentiment favoring an escalation of what I think is already a developing Cold War with China. And frankly, I think that Americans have developed a sense of military complacency after fighting wars with Afghanistan and Iraq. First of all, those wars didn't go very well. We lost a lot of soldiers. But frankly, you know, that's a David and Goliath kind of conflict. China is not Afghanistan. China has enough submarine-launched ballistic missiles to eliminate the United States at the push of a button. That fear that we had during the Soviet Cold War. China's got just as many weapons now as the Soviets had then, probably a lot more, and they also have hypersonic carrier-sinking ballistic missiles. So it seems to me like we could be at the dawn of a new Cold War escalation that is driven by public sentiment, which, frankly, I think President Trump maybe is starting to fan the flames of with some of his comments. What's your reaction? You've worked in the White House. Am I crazy to think that these things might be on the horizon?
I do think it's worth thinking through a thought process here. And so one part of that thought process is, first of all, yes, we're going to have a blame game for sure. And wherever it began, there was going to be a question about who is to blame. And so the fact that it appears to have happened in China, although even that is not yet totally certain, is definitely going to cause some mudslinging and blaming. But it's kind of part of a bigger phenomena, which is the human desire to find the cause and the blame. And as an example, you hear people now saying things like, well, you know, this is because we've been polluting the earth so heavily, and this is Mother Nature getting her own back, which is kind of the same sort of argument as, you know, remember back when AIDS began and people blaming the gay community because it happened to be that it touched them first. It's not like an intentional process. Viruses appear in the environment. They're not targeting people on more moralistic grounds, and they're not targeting nations moralistically either. But having said that, the danger too is that if the economies really seize up and you have an environment where governments are effectively nationalizing the operation of the economy, the question to my mind is, would that increase the propensity to get into confrontation with other nations, or would it diminish it? I can't answer that question right now, but I think it's a reasonable question to start asking. Will it intensify the probability of a more confrontational approach with other countries, or does it diminish that probability?
Pippa, let's tie this all together. This is an investing podcast channel. What does all of this mean for the growth picture, for investments, for markets, and so forth from here?
So I think, you know, look, markets are going to remain bumpy and volatile. You're going to get these moments where you get government intervention and markets rally. Then everybody goes, wait a minute, that's not going to work. And they go back down. I think the opportunity for further legs down here is very real. And that until you let people out of their homes, nobody can actually look and see how bad the damage is. And in fact, when you actually go to do that, when you go to open that Pandora's box to try to see what's the actual situation, it's going to be so ugly that people are going to blame you for opening the box. They're going to say, aha, it's because you went to look. Yeah, but you have to look to find out what is the actual situation that we're in. So I think there's a whole lot of blame and bad feelings that's going to happen. And this is going to make it hard for investors to go after traditional financial instruments. And so I think now is the time to think not just tactically about, you know, which kind of assets would you buy or sell, but strategically, what happens to the nature of our society? What happens to the balance of power between states and citizens, states and companies? You know, are we entering a world where the state effectively starts to nationalize everything in practice, if not in name? And if that's the case, how long is that going to last? You know, like the British have talked about, you know, nationalizing the railways. Okay, but running them is a nightmare. Good luck with that. How long do you think they would last? 6 months? Maybe not even. So then privatization. So rather than jumping, you know, you can play the volatility, but I think the bigger question is, what kind of society do you think emerges from all this? And my answer is something that will definitely be investable. Something where a lot of the debt will have been cleared by either deliberate efforts or by accident. And the more debt you get rid of and clear away, the healthier the future will be. So even though that's a grim process to go through, I'm actually pretty optimistic that this may be the jolt that was required to force us to address a lot of the problems that we know have been building for a very long time, but had not been brave enough to face. And maybe this virus is a one-off chance in history to actually write off a whole lot of the debt that's been strangling us to death until now.
Pippa, before I let you go, there's another aspect to this crisis. You know, almost everybody's thinking, boy, this is just all around negative for everybody's business, unless you happen to be in the N95 mask production business. You told me off the air that your business, H Robotics, is actually getting a lot more business rather than less, and a lot more interest, although it's coming from a different direction. Tell us the story of what's going on there.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating. You know, what my company does, we make autonomous vehicles, you know, drones, terrain drones, marine drones. But really what we do is give you the opportunity to use your mobile phone to make a kind of proprietary Google map right now, whenever you want, of your asset on the other side of the world. And also to manage that asset, you can do a delivery from one side of the mining site in Africa to another. And suddenly people were going, wait a minute, why am I traveling to Africa to see a mine or Brazil to see an agribusiness? Or frankly, why am I even crossing the county to go look at something? Or in this current environment, people have, you know, business assets that nobody's guarding because everybody's at home with the virus. And they're going, I need something to protect my site. For all these reasons, now they're like, oh, you mean I could do this from my mobile phone and I can have a terrain vehicle that goes around my property and gives me a live view of exactly what's happening on that property and maybe even allows me to conduct some physical kinetic tasks. Yeah, this I want. So suddenly we're getting phone calls from companies that definitely want all or some combination of our autonomous vehicles. It's part of this broader digitization movement that we talked about earlier. And, you know, companies realizing that they've got human beings doing stuff that they need to make it go digital. And so I just happened to have picked an area where, you know, I anticipated that the market's going to get a lot more digital. And what I supply are tools for digitization. It's just people think about it as a drone, but it's not really a drone. It's a tool for digitizing your assets and then for remote management. And I think the whole thing makes the world economy much smaller and safer because you're going to be able to now buy assets on the other side of the world and be able to see them with a degree of accuracy that's far greater than if you were standing there with your own eyes. You know, now you can see with almost military accuracy something on the other side of the world whenever you want. And I think that it has a much higher value because of this virus event than it even did before.
Well, I think that is a microcosm example of what I predict is going to be a huge trend out of this crisis. I think we're going to come out of this crisis having learned a whole bunch of new tricks out of necessity, where people come out of it saying, you know, in the crisis, we discovered H Robotics drones because they gave us the ability not to have to get on airplanes and expose our staff to risk. But hey, in the process, we figured out it's a better way of doing business. I bet there's going to be just hundreds or thousands of other things that people discover, different products, different technologies that existed before, but nobody knew about them. And out of necessity, we're going to learn about them, and they're probably going to become new trends and change the landscape of the economy going forward. Pippa, we're going to need to leave it there in the interest of time. I really look forward to getting you back. I don't know why it's been so long since we've heard from you. It's been, I think, almost a couple of months, but we'll make it shorter next time. And we look forward to seeing you again soon. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast on quant and rules-based investing. Be sure to claim your free copy of their recently updated guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following strategies, which is linked in your Research Roundup email. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.